Before we get into the study, I wanted to make mention of a tract that's on the back rack by the restrooms, if you haven't already read it or discovered it out there. It's called The Absurdity of Atheism by Kenny Chumbly. Does a pretty good job of breaking down what's wrong with the atheist worldview. Touches a little bit on the resurrection and why that is such a powerful refutation of atheism toward the end of the booklet, and also lists some sources for additional study if you want to pursue this line of study more so on your own. So it's in the back, several copies if you want to pick one up and haven't read it, or if you've got somebody that might be interested in reading it. I think it's a good evangelism tool. Tonight we're talking about the last six appearances of Jesus after his resurrection. How many appearances do we have, or specific mentions of an appearance in the New Testament in total right after his resurrection? I've got them numbered for you there, so it's not hard to see. 12. Yeah, now that should be easy enough to recall, because that's a recurring number in our Bible anyway. Now, we have at least one other appearance other than the 12 that's listed that I did not include here. We talked about it briefly on Sunday. Do you remember which one that is? In Revelation. It appears to John. These 12 are designed to produce faith that he is the risen Messiah. And that one to John, when he wrote Revelation, was designed to encourage and strengthen faith that was being persecuted. If you look in John chapter 21, we read in verse 1, after these things, Jesus manifested himself again to the disciples at the Sea of Tiberias, and he manifested himself in this way. Tonight we'll start with the third of his group appearances to the 12 after his resurrection. Did he first appear to a male disciple in his very first appearance?
No.
No, it was female. Who was it?
Mary.
Mary Magdalene. And shortly after he appears to Mary Magdalene, who does he appear to? You can cheat.
The other
women. And these women show up at the tomb expecting to find him risen from the dead, right? Why did they go to the tomb? Say it out loud.
Oils and spices.
Oils and spices are going to finish the preparation for the body, or the finish the anointing of the body. Are they concerned about who's going to roll the stone back?
Yes.
Yeah, they are. How are we going to get in there to finish the job? So when they show up, they get there and the stone is rolled back, but his body is still in there wrapped up, and they see the exact moment that he comes back to life, right?
No.
Does anybody see the exact moment that he comes back to life?
No.
Anything odd about that?
Probably the angels.
Okay, the angels may have. Anybody in the flesh see him come back to life? No. Anything strange about that?
If you're making up a story, you'd think you'd recall the moment of
everybody. Sure. If this had been fabricated, you'd think somebody would be there the exact moment that it happened. You might also think that it wasn't the women that found him first, if somebody had made this up. You might think it was the male disciples. After he appeared to Mary and the other women, who does he appear to next? Peter. Now, do you read of the exact moment as it occurs when he appears to Peter? You find out about it secondhand, don't you? You find out about it from the two disciples on the road to Emmaus. They heard about it evidently from Jesus. And then, of course, Paul lists it as a separate appearance in the catalog of appearances in 1 Corinthians 15. After he appears to Peter, he appears to the two on the road to Emmaus. One of them, we know his name was Cleopas. We don't know who the other disciple was. About how far was the city of Emmaus, or the town of Emmaus, a little small village really, from the city of Jerusalem?
7 miles.
Now, assuming that Jesus joined them and walked the full 7 miles, roughly how long would this interaction with the Lord have taken?
2 hours.
About 2 hours. 2 hours over a prolonged period of time. They talk to him. They have a logical conversation. Then when they get into the town, what do they ask him to do? Not even knowing who he is yet. Stay with us for a while. They go in. They sit down at a table. And then suddenly they discover that this is the man they've been talking about all along. Didn't realize who it was that they've been speaking to. Anything unusual about the fact that they didn't immediately recognize him? Anything odd about that? What's odd about it?
All the distance they went with.
Yeah, you would think surely it would have been instantaneous, right?
They spent 3 years with him too.
Okay, so there's a good chance they'd spent, we don't know exactly how much time these two had spent with him, but pretty good chance for the last 3 years they'd spent a considerable amount of time with him. Did anybody else fail to recognize him right off the bat?
Mary.
And Mary, was she somebody that just had a distant relationship with Jesus or a very close relationship with Jesus?
Close.
Very close, right? It's odd that they don't immediately recognize him. Does either John or Luke explain why these people don't immediately recognize him?
No.
No. And again, if this were fabricated, what would we expect to find, maybe?
An explanation why.
An explanation why, perhaps, or
they
would have known who he was from the start, right? There wouldn't have been any of this wondering why they didn't know who he was. After he appears to these two, yes?
Just a passing point that somebody is studying with someone on this. He said, we don't know why they didn't recognize him. There was somebody in your class that couldn't understand why you said that because their Bible said why.
Yes.
You agree with that?
Yes, I am. Yeah. Yeah, so some translations, I think that was the NIV.
No, this was Life Application.
Okay.
They called it a Bible, they ought to call it a commentary.
Okay.
Not much translation to it, but they say God would have withheld them their eyes.
Okay.
Of course, the word God's not in the text.
Right.
Mine was ESV.
ESV?
Their eyes were kept from recognizing.
Does it say that God did that specifically? Okay, that's what, or closer at least to what Luke actually said. He just says they were prevented from recognizing him without explaining it. And then some translations say specifically, much, much looser translations, that God actually did it. So that would be something to be aware of if you're talking to someone that doesn't know much about some translations being more faithful to the original text than others. Don?
What would prevent us from contemplating the thought that he prevented them from recognizing? He worked miracles. Why could he not prevent them from recognizing him to test their faith? Is that such a big leap?
It's not for me. I don't know any other way to explain why they wouldn't recognize him unless there was some divine action behind it. I guess the really puzzling thing about it, back to Steve's original comment, you just want to be careful about having a text that's respectful of what the writer actually said and not perhaps drawing inferences that there is no firm ground for. The other thing about it, I guess, that's really troubling to us is we perhaps want a rational explanation as to why that happened, be it to test their faith or whatever. But no such motive is given to us at all in either account as to why there is this moment of no recognition at all. And so for that reason, it is strange to us. Alex?
This is the impasse. I have my easy as a friend there.
Yeah. Well, if he's hung up on that, I think he's just not seeing the forest for the trees. There's so many other things that we'll discuss as we go along. And again, I would point out that if he thinks that this was just a big scam, then the writers would not have included this strange happening in these appearances. It runs counterintuitive to what we'd expect if people were taken in under false pretenses.
Yeah, all he's got to do is go two more steps down the road. They did recognize him.
Right. Eventually, yes. Yeah.
Now, and that's do that. Right. About the first part, they did recognize him.
Right. And then later in our lesson tonight, we have another guy that did not spend 3.5 years with the other disciples, but he became convinced from an appearance. That's Paul. And he's certainly not going to be fooled by someone that's an imposter and has no credentials to show to prove that he is who he claimed to be. So it's sad that they would make that a stumbling block for them. And after the two on the road to Emmaus, we have Jesus appearing to the 12 without Thomas. And then when he does appear with them, with Thomas, that takes place 1 week later. You read about those two appearances in John 20 and the back half of the chapter. And then we get to John 21, where he tells us after these things, Jesus again appeared to them. So this is now his third appearance, where we'll pick up tonight. Is there another comment? Ennis. I don't know how to explain it, and it's because John didn't explain it. I don't know that that's why he tells her that. If anything, the indication seems to be that she just wants to hold him down and never let him go. She's done lost him twice. She lost him on the cross. She lost him when she showed up and the tomb was empty and his body wasn't there. She thought somebody had desecrated his tomb, and she doesn't want to turn him loose again. And that seems to be why he's so adamant that she let him go. He's got to continue. It's not enough for him to come back and be seen. He's got to go back to heaven. Yes?
And it's the one place, you know, where he had the breaking of the bread with his disciples. He said, I will not drink the fruit of this vine from now on until that day when I drink it with you in my Father's kingdom. And they recognized him as soon as he broke bread with them. I always wonder if that had
I don't know. That's something I would have to give some thought to offhand. I don't know if that would be. About the not breaking bread with them until he broke it with them in his kingdom at the supper, and then them not recognizing until he sat down and ate. Of course, in the appearance that Luke records, they do recognize him before he takes food and eats. They're startled simply by his appearance in their midst before that happens, and they think they've seen a ghost. All right, John 21. Look at verse 2. Simon Peter, Thomas, Nathanael, the sons of Zebedee. How many people would the sons of Zebedee make up?
Two.
Two? What are their names?
James and John.
James and John. So we've got Simon Peter, Thomas, Nathanael, James and John, and two others. How many people are going to witness this one? Add it up. Seven? Is everybody as bad at math as I am in this class? Seven people, right? In verse 2. One of the things that people say when they're confronted with the appearances of Jesus is that these were mass hallucinations. And first of all, I don't know of a single instance of a mass hallucination. And by mass hallucination, you mean more than one person hallucinating the exact same thing. If there are any recorded instances of mass hallucinations, they are all found in the New Testament. By itself, that is interesting, that the only time there would ever be mass hallucinations, they are all in connection with Jesus of Nazareth. In verse 3, Simon Peter said to them, I'm going fishing. And they said to him, we will come with you. They went out and got into the boat. That night they caught nothing. When the day was now breaking, Jesus stood on the beach, yet the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. Again, that's counterintuitive. We think for making this up, we'd know who it is right off the bat. Jesus said to them, children, you do not have any fish, do you? They answered him, no. He said to them, cast the net on the right-hand side of the boat, and you will find a catch. So they cast, and then they were not able to haul it in because of the great number of fish. Later on in the text, we read that they caught 153 fish. The disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, it is the Lord. So when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put his outer garment on, for he was stripped for work, and threw himself into the sea. But the other disciples came in the little boat. They were not far from the land, about 100 yards away, dragging the net full of fish. Now, in verse 9, when they get to the beach, there's a fire that's already been lit. Fish are placed on it, as well as bread. Now, think about this. One of the explanations for the resurrection appearances is these guys just had an experience that was all in their head. Well, do hallucinations account for 153 fish, verse 11? Do hallucinations account for a net being torn in verse 11? Do they account for a fire already being prepared, a meal being prepared, and some bread? Do they account for breakfast, verse 12? Do hallucinations fill your belly? Here's another question. Can you be talked out of a hallucination? That's a question that comes up with people that may be dying of cancer. And they sometimes may have these strange things going on in their head where they think that there's a phone in their left hand and it's ringing and they need to answer it. Maybe somebody, their spouse or whatever, will tell them that phone is not there. And they'll snap out of it and say, oh, you're right. But here are seven men, one of whom is beheaded, if I remember correctly, in Acts 12. Is that right, James? Steve? Yes. They could not be talked out of this. They could not be convinced otherwise that they did not see the Lord. In verse 13, Jesus came and took the bread and gave it to them, and the fish likewise. Then John tells us in verse 14, this is now the third time that he was manifested to the disciples after he was raised from the dead. If this is a hallucination, pretty powerful hallucination. Give me some more hallucinations like that. We could solve world hunger with those kinds of hallucinations. Since they filled their bellies, gave them this wonderful, tremendous catch of fish that even ruined their nets. Let's turn over to Matthew chapter 28. We have seven disciples in John 21. At the close of Matthew's Gospel, chapter 28 and verse 16, we have 11. So now we got four more guys that hallucinate the exact same thing. The exact same thing. A person that they never expected to see again after he went to the cross. So they're certainly in no state of mind to be imagining this kind of encounter. In verse 17, this is an interesting statement, and again, it's counterintuitive. You wouldn't expect to find this if this was all made up. They saw him, they worshipped him, but then what does the text say?
Some doubted.
Some doubted? What? Surely not now. He's come back from the dead. Surely not now. They know that it's him. They saw where the nails pierced his hands and his feet, and the spear was thrust in his side. Surely they don't doubt. I don't know why necessarily they doubted. I don't know what's going through their heads. I just know that that just seems really odd. If Matthew's trying to lie to people and convince them, in spite of the evidence that this carpenter was the Son of God, I think he's an idiot to put something like that in there if he's making it up. Look at 1 Corinthians 15. Can anybody tell me approximately when 1 Corinthians was written? 57 AD. So that is within 30 years of the resurrection. Very, very early in time. It's a good thing for us to know that date for a few reasons. First of all, it lets us know that there were written accounts of what happened back then in verses 3 and 4, the kernel of the gospel and following, in a very short amount of time, and that makes it difficult, or at least a little more difficult, for legends and myths to creep into the story. Now, some people respond by saying, well, you know, even 30 years on the scene after the events happened, memory can still be corrupted. People can still forget details, and that is true. For example, Wally, can you tell me anything that you had for breakfast in 1963?
Yeah.
On a specific day and a specific meal?
Yeah.
You can.
You didn't eat breakfast. Right?
You didn't eat breakfast. Okay.
Try to lie, so I'll say no.
Yeah. What about you, Steve? I know you eat breakfast. But where were you on November
22nd?
Right. But where were you on November the 22nd, 1963? Yeah, you do. That's the day JFK was shot. Where were you?
I was at a Gibson store in Orange County.
So why do you remember that, but you don't remember what you had for breakfast?
Significant event.
Right. John, you remember anything you had for breakfast and on a given day in 2001? You remember where you were on 9/11? Okay. So for these people, in verses 3 and following, this is the 11:22:63. This is the 9/11:01 for them. So surely the memory is going to be a little bit sharper when it comes to these kind of things as opposed to what they would have been eating and drinking back then. This is a great, great boon to our faith. Now, even within this, you've got another thing. Here's this catalog of appearances, and then you get to verse 6. After that, he appeared to more than 500 brethren at one time, most of whom remain until now, but some have fallen asleep. Now, sure, he doesn't list anybody specifically by name, but that's a striking figure, 500 people at once. I might be willing to concede that 7 people hallucinated the same thing. I might be willing to concede that 11 people hallucinated the same thing, but you are really pushing it with 500. And not only that, but when Paul mentions it, and then he says, most of whom remain until now, but some have fallen asleep. First of all, what does that even mean when he says some have fallen asleep? Some are dead, but not all of them. Most of them are still alive. What has he just done to his own credibility? Has he opened himself up in any way to fact-checking? That's quite a bold statement to make. What if I was skeptical and I decided I wanted to write Paul back and ask him, give me some more details about that? What if he couldn't provide me any more details about it?
Then I think he's making it up.
Yeah, you think he's making it up. And then we might think we wouldn't have as much of this New Testament put together if he had been exposed as a fraud, perhaps. Bold statement to make. Not necessarily so much for what it says about the Lord and his appearances, although that in itself is remarkable, but even more so, it gives credibility to Paul.
Todd, your two examples with President being shot at 9/11, if I or whoever you asked, was it Alex back about that?
John.
He said that, and somebody questioned it, it would be easy, and they said, look, billions of people.
Yeah. Yeah, so you got the same thing here with this. Yeah. So, all right, Paul, you say that happened. Well, Paul says, yeah, I'm not the only one that says that it happened. There's a lot more people that say the same thing. Yeah. Good point.
They might have questioned his credibility of these people right there that were living when he did.
Exactly. And not just people in his own time that would have questioned his credibility, but did he have any enemies at Corinth? Yeah, right. We just studied that for 3 months, right? So, yes, he's really opening himself up to scrutiny by including that in this letter to these people. Look in verse 7. After the appearance to the 500, he appears to James. Anybody know which James this is? The text doesn't say, but by process of elimination, you can more or less guess within a high degree of probability who it's going to be.
James' brother.
It'd be his brother. What is significant about James being included in a list of appearances that are designed to confirm that Jesus did, in fact, come back from the dead?
You have a close relative that can confirm the story as well.
That's a big part of it. If anybody knows who this person is going to be, it's going to be somebody that grew up in the same household with him. That's a big part of it. There's another thing about it, though.
There was some time at odds.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Look, for example, in John chapter 7. John chapter 7. In verse 1. After these things, Jesus was walking in Galilee, for he was unwilling to walk in Judea, because the Jews were seeking to kill him. Now the feast of the Jews, the feast of Booths, was near. Therefore his brother said to him, leave here and go into Judea, so that your disciples also may see your works which you are doing. For no one does anything in secret when he himself seeks to be known publicly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world. Verse 5, for not even his brothers were believing in him. Now, again, if you're making this up, you're probably not going to say that one of the people that perhaps roughhoused with Jesus growing up knew him just as well or better than anybody else, his own flesh and blood. You're probably not going to say that they were a doubter. But that's exactly what we have. And not only that, but the challenge that they lay down in verses 3 and 4 essentially is, stick your neck out. Now, perhaps since they were doubters, they didn't expect him to really go through with it. So maybe they felt like they weren't really daring him to do all that much. But back in verse 1, we're told there's a reason why he's not going into Judea. They want to kill him. So he's avoiding hostile people with evil motives for a reason. But his brothers say, if you're the real deal, just go stick yourself out there. Throw yourself out. His brothers do not show up. As best I can tell, there's no indication that they were even present at the crucifixion when their own brother was being murdered. If you look in John 19, obviously his mother Mary is there. It's interesting as you go through the gospel accounts, because some of the women disciples, they had at times more faith than the male disciples did. They at least had enough faith that Jesus would die. One of them takes time to prepare his body for the burials. He's at least confident that he will do that. And even though he's told the male disciples plainly that he would die, they still don't believe that. So you have women that are there, and verse 25, standing by the cross of Jesus were his mother's sister, Mary the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. When Jesus then saw his mother and the disciple whom he loved, which would be who?
John.
Standing nearby, he said to his mother, "Woman, behold your son." Then he said to the disciple, "Behold your mother." From that hour, the disciple took her into his own household. Here is a moment where Jesus commits the charge and care of his mother to one of the other disciples that is not a flesh and blood relative. And it just makes me wonder, where are his brothers? Perhaps they didn't even have enough faith that he would die. I don't know what they were thinking, but they were certainly, as you go through the gospel accounts, people that did not believe his word. When you get to Acts chapter 1, though, after Jesus has made 11 of his appearances just before his ascension back into heaven, in verse 12, this is the 11, they returned to Jerusalem from the mount called Olivet, which is near Jerusalem, a Sabbath day's journey. And then you read of their number in verse 13. And in verse 14, these all with one mind were continually devoting themselves to prayer, along with the women and Mary, the mother of Jesus, and with his brothers. And something has changed. And not just James, but all of them. But James in particular is mentioned in 1 Corinthians 15. As you go through the book of Acts and you get to Jerusalem in Acts 15, you see that James is a prominent figure at the Jerusalem church and in the debate that is conducted over whether or not Gentiles have to keep the law to be saved. When you get to the book of James, which is believed to have been written by this brother of the Lord, the book of James chapter 1, in verse 2, first of all, he identifies himself in the very first sentence of the book as a bondservant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ. And then in verse 2, he writes, "Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance. Let endurance have its perfect result, so that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing." Here's a man that, with full contentment, is willing to suffer for the cause of Jesus Christ. Goes from skeptical sibling to suffering servant. Now, how do you explain it?
He witnessed the resurrection.
Exactly.
It's interesting, these particular individuals that you're focusing on, like the 7 at the sea. A couple of these guys we know are pretty tough guys to convince. There's Thomas. We know what happened with him. There's Nathaniel. Remember in John 1, he was not easily convinced. And even when Jesus called his name, how do you know? He wanted some evidence. And then John was there. And then John later wrote 1 John. We saw him, we've touched him, we've handled him. And then now you mentioned James. This is 57. Jerusalem meeting was at 50. Approximately 49 or 50. In Jerusalem meeting, although Paul had been on a journey, worked miracles, after he got up and spoke, James did what you said a while ago. He fact-checked people. He said, well, yeah, this is what the prophet said. In other words, James was not wowed by the fact it was the Apostle Paul, and yet now Paul is calling on James as a witness. Man who has readily stood up against him. That's evident in the Jerusalem meeting.
Right.
Had it not been so.
So he's an independent thinker, just like Paul, who we definitely want to make note of that here shortly. We got just a few minutes left. I want to briefly touch on Luke 24. If you did not know this already, Luke 24, the final verses in the chapter are one event that is told two times. The second time it is told is in the beginning of Luke's sequel book in Acts chapter 1. And in a later class, we'll perhaps look at how whether or not there are any contradictions in these two tellings of the same event. When you look in Luke chapter 24 and verse 44, Jesus begins to explain the law of Moses and what was prophesied about Jesus. In verse 46, thus it is written, the Christ would suffer and rise again from the dead the third day, that repentance for forgiveness of sins would be proclaimed in his name to all the nations, beginning from Jerusalem. Verse 48, you are witnesses of these things. The plan was never for us to have a blind faith in the gospel of the risen Lord. There would be men handpicked to bear witness to his resurrection. They would not be the only ones to bear witness. There would be others that would corroborate their testimony, including one man who, at least for a few years, would have gladly killed these people. So what a great, great boon to our faith it is that we have testimony and evidence for what we believe. We don't have to believe it simply because people before us believed it or because we are just told to believe it and everything will work out okay. Now, let's look over at Paul in Acts chapter 9. Let's talk about Paul. Not a disciple. Don't read about him at all in the gospel accounts. So he's certainly not somebody that was expecting to see the risen Lord. If anything, he would have thought the Lord's work was being done when they nailed him to the cross. Stood there when Stephen was being stoned, gladly consented to his death, guarded the coats of the men that were killing him. And then as he's going around the Middle East trying to do as much harm as he can to Christians, he's confronted with this stranger that meets him. In verse 5, who are you, Lord? He said, I am Jesus whom you're persecuting. Get up, enter the city, it will be told you what you must do. The men who traveled with him stood speechless, hearing the voice, but seeing no one. Saul got up from the ground, and though his eyes were open, he could see nothing. Leading him by the hand, they brought him to Damascus. Very familiar account to all of us. In the 1700s, there was a man named Lord George Lyttleton. Did I say that right? Okay, if you want to look him up, spelled L-Y-T-T. L-Y-T-T-L-E, Littleton, T-O-N. Yeah.
We got some lessons coming back.
Okay, good, good. He was an Englishman who was a skeptic. He did not believe in Christianity. So he decided one day he was going to test it, and he began to study the conversion of Paul. As he studied the conversion of Paul, he discovered that, first of all, Paul could not have been dishonest. And here's why. Here's a man that knew what was in store for anybody that confessed the name of Jesus. Then he decides he's going to give up every advantage that he had as a Jew and do the same thing. Now, what's waiting for him once he does that?
What he's been doing.
Yes, the very persecutions that he has levied against other people. Lord Littleton says, I do not believe that he could have been dishonest. He said, I don't think that he could have been deluded. Paul had a cool, rational mind. That's obvious from all of his writings. He's a man that fact-checks things. He's a man that is interested in what has been written. You see that clearly time and time again throughout the books that we have by his own hand. He said he's also not a man who was dependent. This was an independent thinker. Paul was a man that went around saying, I didn't get my gospel from anybody else. And Paul's a man that's not afraid to stand up to Peter, as is recorded for us in Galatians. He's not afraid to make his own stand and think for himself when it comes to the meeting and the debate over circumcision in Jerusalem. He's a guy that is a rugged individualist, thinks for himself, lives his own life. As Mr. Littleton went through his examination of the conversion of Paul, he decided there must be something to this after all. How else do you explain what makes this man go from 1 to 180? Yes, Ennis. Yes. Yeah, definitely. He lived his life with a very high degree of integrity, seemed to know who he was and what he was about very early on in his life, and brought that to bear both as a Jew and as a Christian.
And highly educated.
Highly educated, that too. Not a dummy by any stretch. And that's evident even by people that don't share the faith that he did in Jesus. They can at least acknowledge that honestly when they read his writings. All right, any other thoughts or comments before we into our study tonight? So these are the 12 appearances of Jesus that support the gospel claim that he came back from the dead. And this concludes our survey of the kernel of the gospel. Two primary facts. He died. What's the supporting fact that he died? He was buried. And then, of course, he came back from the dead. And the supporting fact for that is that he appeared. We have an awful lot of medical evidence for his death. And we know far more about his manner of death and burial than we do for many other historical figures from antiquity. The nature of his resurrection and his appearances both often are counterintuitive in how they play out. And this calls into question the claims that skeptics make that all this was made up after the fact. Okay, next week, hopefully starting on Sunday, we will talk about how old these documents are that talk about his death, burial, and resurrection. And we'll talk about the mistakes, so-called, in them. Yes, Alex?
So not believing in the resurrection of Christ is almost akin to not believing in the Holocaust.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, and it's interesting that you mentioned that, because one of the charges that people make about the gospel writers is that they were biased, and so you can't trust them. Does anybody know who runs the Holocaust museums, though?
Jews.
You think they're biased?
Nah.
Yes, they are. You better believe it. They have a lot of skin in the game, right? They want people to know about the Holocaust. But nobody goes around and says, well, you can't trust their scholarship because that's just a bunch of Jews running the museum. So what if these men are biased? I'm biased. When it comes to the gospel, I'll admit I want to believe in it. The question is whether or not I've got good reason to. And all of us ought to be honest enough and willing to admit our biases and not pretend that everybody can go around through life dispassionately and not have any personal preference with anything relative to truth or how the world works or what lies beyond. Baloney. All right, bell's about to ring.